Okay, I've just pushed record.
Whoa.
It's happened.
It's
Hello, everyone.
the logo. What are we, Chris?
We are two human beings on a interesting planet flying through the solar system. Some might call us a beautiful accident of thermal dynamics. Thermal dynamics? Thermodynamics.
Thermo. Yeah, here you go.
Yes, the thermal, because it's a bit warm in here actually, and I haven't even put the heating on. Yeah, I'm trying to basically, I'm trying to keep it as long into the year as possible without putting the heating on, and I think I'm doing all right so far.
Oh, I was trying to do that, but yeah, I caved.
Oh, I'm still going. This is acrylic jumper. It feels horrible to wear, but it is warm as hell. So, and it's quite thin.
This house is very, very high ceilingy, drafty,
Oh,
holes in the
so.
walls.
This is the first podcast, Freebooters. Is that what we're calling it? We're the Freebooters?
Yeah, I'm cool. Yeah, freebooters.
Yeah.
I like that.
Okay, cool. Yep. And I think that sort of nails what we're trying to do. It's going to be
Yeah.
a sort of a free software, free culture, free boot-in kind of podcast where it's going to be very casual, very lo-fi, low fidelity. We're distinctly not going to put too much effort into this because one thing I have noticed about podcasts, and people who don't make podcasts don't notice this, is it's more than just like they end up being so much work, don't they?
And also something I've been thinking about quite a lot recently, watching board game videos on YouTube, is that the more effort and the more production quality, production value stuff, effort they put it, that wasn't a sentence, but you get me. The more effort they put in along those lines, like if you draw a graph, like the effort goes up exponentially, and the quality of the video just goes up slightly.
Yes,
It's really not
absolutely.
worth it. Like when you particular channels, you go back to like their first few videos and the sound quality is a bit shitty and the camera's a bit like, it's a webcam or something, but you don't enjoy that video any less than their most recent ones where they're, thousands of pounds worth of equipment going into it.
Yeah, and the work goes up and then the fun goes down. And I've already got a job, so I don't want to do double work, really. That's
And I just
so
don't want to do work.
yeah. Though it's yeah, and it's been the case. Like we've both been on our fair share of podcasts over the years, and like I've found that it's very hard to avoid them being work. So we're going to try very hard to avoid work, which is I suppose kind of like fits in the name a little bit, really. Freebooting, and also I think we're probably going to be like it feels to me from our like chat and set up and all this kind of stuff that we're going to be kind of like a little bit more like Fediverse based, right? Like that feels like sort of like a natural home for the podcast, right?
It's a
Like
little
small.
bit just us because we're gonna be talking about games and TV shows we like and stuff like that. So it's just, us and what we're into, but with a backbone, a core of small internet, Fediverse, Fosse-ish, right?
Yep, that's pretty much it. Yeah. If you have any like comments, feedback, or like talking points or questions or anything like that, the best place to catch us is on the Fediverse itself. I'll drop an email down in the description comment section, whatever the heck it's going to be. And but really, if you want to catch us, have a conversation, just come up with us join us on the Fediverse, really. It's a fun old place, and it's a bit more lighter because actually we can move on to the first thing that I've got hastily jotted down on my notepad. Email, right? Because email is like the small tech that everyone uses. But I think now, like, even a few people at home have sort of probably clocked that actually, to the majority of people in the world, there are really only two email providers, Outlook and Gmail, right? Is it
And
still a thing, really?
I yeah, so you're kind of almost saying email doesn't really exist anymore. We've just got two web apps
Yes.
that do what we asynchronous long form communication.
Yeah.
I think that's a fair call. I think I said to you earlier that it's email's predominantly become like a notification mechanism for corporations.
And the tax man.
The text man.
But yeah, it's like.
And it's sad because email, it's one of the first internet protocols, right? And this is something that I guess, like, I don't want to be patronizing, but younger people don't realize that it's not, it's a protocol. It's one of the internet protocols. It's not part of the web. It's not, It's a very simple protocol. It's a deeply insecure protocol. You know, the fact that you can just spoof a sender address, you can just put any sender, and it looks like you know. But it's got that benefit that so many of these open protocols had back in the day of just pure, like, real simplicity, and that's its beauty, right?
Yes, but also, I mean, I've heard many people rant and rave on the Fediverse about the terrors of setting up your own email server, for example. Mm-hmm. Now, how prohibitive that is like debatable, right? The idea behind things like email and even like chat as well is, and even the Fediverse itself, is like you shouldn't necessarily expect to run your own server, right? One of the benefits of the sort of the collectivism of it all is that people that know can run the server for a community of people around it.
And I think that's really important. Yeah. Because I think when you get to the nerdier, I almost want to say like more masculine end of the spectrum, there's this you've got to host it yourself kind of mentality, right? Which I think is off-putting to the kind of people who, you know, don't want to, don't know how to, don't can't afford to. It's I agree with what you're saying. Sorry.
Like the community has to lift and carry itself, and not everyone's going to be a system admin, nor should they, right? Like, I don't expect in society everyone to be a mechanic or everyone to be an electrician or a plumber or anything like that.
Well, also, I'm capable of running all of these servers, and I have a lot of free time. But I don't want to run an email server and a web server and a video streaming server and a Mastodon server. Like, I don't want to do that. I'm not interested in that.
Right? It's work, yeah. And you know how we feel about work on this podcast. So yeah, it's. But also, like. I do hear about people like getting through things like spam filters, you know, and there are a lot of spam filters. They're working on the basis of, well, if it doesn't come from Gmail, it doesn't come from Outlook, is a good chance it's spam.
What I've heard is if you're running your own mail server and you get on one of those, you know, if somebody just happens to use your SMTP server to send some emails and they're scams, then you're on a list, and it's incredibly hard to get off that list.
Yeah, and there have been people that have written very interesting blog articles about how these lists should be managed, but at the end of the day, we live in the world that is, not the world that should be, right? And
I mean, really, because email is such a simple protocol that, I mean, it was originally for people on Unix machines to send messages to people on the same network, right? This is pre-internet. It was for, we are both users of a particular mainframe and we're sending messages to each other. That was what it was for, and it has a security model for that. So when it's introduced to the internet, that is an inadequate security model, and all these layers we've been putting on top of it have been fighting that. Really, there should have been an email too that was made for the internet. But as far, I mean, this might be my ignorance, but as far as I know, that never, you know, that was never the case. So all of these things we do are fighting against that fact, really.
Yeah. And also, of course, it technology, there's like an organic social element to a lot of this technology as well. So there's an app that I really love the concept of called Delta Chat, which takes your email and it puts it into a chat format. So like WhatsApp, like XMPP, you know, Discord, well, kind of like Discord, you know, like your basic chat apps. And I think that's a great idea, right? Because anyone with email can reply to a message or anything like that. And I have installed it on my phone before, and I've tried to use it, and it never just ends up clicking. It never ends up taking off.
I like it as a... Because I think lowest common denominator technologies are important, because, you know, the modern internet in particular, the modern web, and modern technology in general has an incredible cost of entry, right? Yeah. And if we're thinking about people in, you know, poorer global south countries, or just poorer people in, you know, global north countries, it can be prohibitive. So having something like WhatsApp that just uses email, you know, anybody can run email. That's cool. Yeah. That's a good idea. And, you know, just in case, you know, these services ever go down, which of course inevitably that, you know, they all will. All of these corporate backed services will at some point fail, probably. That's good. I built up that like I had a point and I can't remember it, or I don't. I'm not sure. Carry on. Sorry.
Well, so even the valiant attempts to try and sort of bring email into the 21st century haven't worked. And if I wanted to be social, and I think it's because the paradigm has shifted, right? we like email is like writing letters, and maybe something like your chat network is like a more modern equivalent of phone calls, right? Like it's think the social expectations have changed, and we do have open protocols for the chat network, but the chat paradigm, the, you know, short message, not signing off, all that kind of stuff, you know, that's taken over as what we chat as, really, right? You're not going to send an email for fun, because it seems it's got a formal structure to it, right?
I think there is kind of, in theory, there's a paradigmatic difference between synchronous communication, which chat apps represent, and asynchronous communication, and, you know, potentially more long form, that email represents, right?
Do you think, but, did you say chat is synchronous though? I mean, it can be if you're having a back
by design voice. I mean, by design.
Oh, right, yeah.
Like, you see the message immediately, you know, it's intended as a real-time communication thing, chat is. That's kind of where I was going. I think because any real-time thing can also serve as an asynchronous thing, people just use, I think if people want to do what we used to do with email, that whatever their preferred service is, you know, Discord or WhatsApp or what's that one for dick pics? Sorry, for penis pics.
Snapchat,
Facebook messaging, you know, whatever they use, they'll just send their long form messages on that these days, because why not, really? And, you know, why not?
Yeah, I sent my mum a copy and pasted news article on WhatsApp the other day.
Yeah, yeah.
I just, because it's like, you know, like the advertising on news websites is just absurd.
And then, you know, but in terms of their design, that would make some more sense on email, but we've lost that. I think email's kind of lost the battle, right? Email. I mean, I still like email, and I use Muck for email. I love interacting with email with Muck, because it's so comfortable. But yeah, you know, I spend most of my, whenever I'm talking to people, it's voice on the internet these days, and, you know, voice, chatting on Discord.
And also, the thing I actually do quite like about WhatsApp is the voice notes. Actually, there's people I voice
yeah,
note
yeah,
with.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I find that, because it's more personal, you know, and also I think it's a really nice way of communicating voice notes.
You can also do it when, like, while you're doing something else, right? You know, to write a message, you have to stop what you're doing. And whereas if you're like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, like when I go for lunch at work, I'll often try, like, I'll go down the park, you know, stretch your legs, feed the ducks, all that kind of stuff. And I can text, and sometimes I do text, but, like, it's a great chance to catch. It's so much easier to catch up on a voice note.
Yeah,
and it's like having a telephone conversation with other people I know who are also at work, but maybe preoccupied with something.
I've got to say, it's kind of a shame that I don't know what term to use. It's not really FOSS, but, you know, amateurism didn't get there first, because, like, a mechanism for sending voice messages to each other, asynchronous voice messages to each other, we've got, like, I could probably write that. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a shame we didn't get there first years ago.
Yeah, but the thing
it's a shame that WhatsApp is the default for doing that, because it's kind of unnecessary.
You can do it. I think you can do it on Snapchat. I'm sure there are others that you can do it on.
You know what I mean, though. It could have been, that could have been a protocol or a you know, a free service.
Yeah, I think this is where the corporate internet web gets the edge on us. It's not that it's not on technology. It's on spending a lot of money, like surveying people and working out what people.
Yeah,
you know, working out people's habits, and they can do this off the back of obviously huge data sets, and they've got money to do all kinds of research that, you know, your average FOSS product isn't going to do. Like, I'm sure we've
also just having the users, I think, is important. Like you know, if I 10 years ago had launched, you know, a program where you can send asynchronous voice messages, you know, getting it out there is the problem. Whereas WhatsApp, with its millions of users, can just go, we've added this feature and people will use it because it's handy, right?
Yeah, and I mean, it'd be interesting to see, like, over the years, how, like, it's quite common for a company to add a feature, realize it's not worth it, and then withdraw it. Like, with the FOSS thing, because there's so much people power involved, and because of how it works and how people feel towards it, the human element, as it were, it's you can't just drop. You know, cut stuff out, drop stuff in, because it's
cumulative. It's like a sedimentary rock, right? You never take anything out.
Yeah,
I know. You're like, whenever they want to with, you know, with the Linux kernel, whenever they want to remove support for like some CPU that nobody's used for 50 years, like there's always a huge controversy. Like somebody will be like, "No, I still use that."
Yeah, yeah, like dropping 32-bit.
Yeah.
So Debian will be supporting 32-bit until, you know, when we're on, when everyone's got a quantum computer in their house or whatever.
The problem is though, like for us, games, right? Yeah. All of the get, like, you know, of all the games that we want to play, what proportion of them were made before, you know?
For sure, but like, surely Wine can be a translation layer for 32-bit stuff, right?
Hang on, can 64-bit Wine can run 32-bit? Yeah.
So has Linux actually conquered that frontier without, with this?
Do you need the 32-bit? Like, yeah, no, see, this is where I'm not technical enough to understand what I'm talking about. Sorry,
Although I'll tell you what, right? Like,
Mac did it, right?
Well, Mac did it, and I'm surprised.
It caused
upset, but I'm surprised that Mac is still, because like one day it wasn't even from like there wasn't it wasn't like because like with Macs you're expected to get a new machine every couple of years, right?
Yeah.
So there's that like that natural clean break built in, but Mac didn't do that. They were just like one day you did a system upgrade and suddenly most of your Steam library just stopped working.
I got a friend who games on Mac, right? And she plays Hades and we also play Left 4 Dead 2 together, right? Mm-hmm. And I think there's on the modern versions of Mac OS you can play Hades and not Left 4 Dead. And on the older ones, you can play Left 4 Dead and not Hades. And there's like a small overlap of like one release where you can play both.
Yeah.
So she had to go through like quite a rigmarole of downgrading to the one that would play both.
Yeah. I don't understand how Mac, like I understand like this sales appeal about Mac, right? Like you've got a machine, it's a bit nailed down, it's a bit of a walled garden, but it's reliable, it's safe. You know, the App Store stops you from getting weird viruses and stuff like that. But I know so many like Macs that struggle on a technical basis that you upgrade and something breaks, or like hard drives.
The thing is, it's getting like outside of games, does it affect anything? Because Apple have never cared about gaming, right? And well, I don't think it affects anything outside of gaming. And I think that's kind of for Mac. I'm to be honest, I'm glad that somebody did it because we do need to drop 32-bit.
Yeah, but they could have done it at a better time or in a better way. Like it was just.
I'm not sure because like no matter how much warning you give, like 32-bit games aren't gonna like, you know, like Deus Ex isn't suddenly gonna go, yeah, we'll release a 64-bit version. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's at some point we've got to cut that. We've got to cut that. What's the expression? Cut the cord. Yeah.
Yeah. Cut the umbilical cord. Yeah. I mean, I guess, but. I don't know. Like, I don't know how you do it. The thing is, that is a fair point, right? Like, but sure. I mean, can a compatibility layer do it? Can a virtual machine do it?
Compatibility layer, virtual machine, like a sandboxy technology, like Snaps and the other one. What's the other one?
Flatpak, App Image.
Flatpak. Yeah, I think they can all do it.
Yeah. So
I don't think App Images could because I don't think they run there.
No.
Actually, I'm not sure which could and which couldn't. But like, you can certainly, that's a way of doing it, right? I did actually try it. Yeah. I did try once to, I got rid of 32-bit on my machine and ran Steam in a Flatpak.
And that worked.
You know, that worked. Yeah, that worked for running the 32-bit games and stuff. I eventually, Flatpak Steam didn't really work well for me. So I've gone back now. But yeah, it was more, you know, to see if it worked.
For a lot of people, of course, they could use NVIDIA's GeForce Now, and that would just solve the problems.
I think streaming's interesting there. Yeah,
I'm still on GeForce Now, and I'm on a very mediocre graphics card that works just the way I like it. I've got everything just the way I like it. It's not the fastest computer that you're going to get, but it everything's nicely compatible with everything I'm running. I don't play many AAA games. Like I do try and play open source games as much as I can these days, but you know, every now and then you got that itch to scratch, and there are some games like that you can't just that there is no FOSS equivalent. A lot of like single player story based games, stuff like that. It's nostalgia trips as well. But GeForce Now is great for that kind of thing. Like it's yeah. you know.
Yeah, I think streaming is a good. Speaking of yeah. graphics cards, by the way, during I don't know whether it was related, but during the hot weather, my graphics card went kaput. And you know, graphics cards are ridiculously expensive at the moment, and I had to replace it. Right, so yeah. I had a GTX 1070, which is not like you know not the most recent, but that's a pretty powerful card, bad, right? Yeah, that's a good card. It ran everything on decent settings. You know, blah blah blah. And I could not afford, and that's a 5-year-old card, something like that. It's a good few years old. I could not afford to replace it with something as powerful. Replace it with something as powerful is like, you know, £500, which I absolutely could not. I was pushing like 200 was like the absolute maximum I could spend in that. Yeah. So I ended up spending £200 on quite a significant downgrade, which is a little bit sad. But at the same time, it doesn't, you know, there's certain games that are fairly graphically intensive that I ran on the 1070, which now run very poorly. Right.
Yeah.
But like the majority of what I run is, you know, indie stuff, and you know it runs fine. I kind of had a point with this, and again I've meandered, but I like that. It sounds weird, but I like that I've got a less powerful graphics card.
Yeah. I think it
forces you to make do a little bit, and I think making do is good.
I totally agree. Yeah, I mean, first, like, the indie space is great. Like, it's the only place, yeah. really, where I see innovation that means anything. As well as, of course, like, you don't get the loot boxes, you don't get the advertising, you don't get the constant, like, even, like, one of my favorite series of games, Hitman, they're always bringing out this new add-on and this new add-on, this new add-on. There's too much content, right? Like, the game is too big. I'm not spending hundreds of hours on this kind of stuff. It's you know, you can see where the money spinning is coming into all of this, and
I think that's just very quickly, like, that's kind of interesting, because the reason games are structured like that now is to keep you interested, to keep you coming back, right? Which, and there must be a huge proportion of people for whom that works, but for me, and I think it sounds like for you, I just find it tiring.
Yeah.
Like, I just want to come back to this game as and when I feel like coming back to it. I don't know what it feels like. It feels like somewhere between nagging and marketing and advertising and like an emotional manipulation. Because games from big studios, like, I mean, they have people there whose job is to work out how to best psychologically manipulate people into, you know, like, never stopping playing, right? Especially, you know, the games as a service kind of games. And that is a deeply unhealthy thing.
And it doesn't, and it feels like it, right? Like, that's one of the reasons, like, it feels less of a game, more of a, like, a product, or like a, it feels like you're just going through some mechanic, you know.
And I think you feel it, because, I mean, they're very good at what they're doing. They are very good at psychologically manipulating, and it's everything. It runs throughout the design. It's the sound design. It's the noises it makes. It's, you know, the way things animate, you know. It's just drip feeding you dopamine, right?
Yeah.
But you feel... I think there comes a point where you feel like you're playing the game out of compulsion rather than enjoyment. You're playing...
Exactly, yeah.
I think I would compare it to, like, this is from my parents' generation, like, the soap, they would watch soap operas, right?
Yeah.
And I swear, if there was ever, like, a 2-week period where they couldn't watch the soap opera for some reason, they come back, they didn't care the less about it. They wouldn't start watching it again. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's that you need to escape...
Yeah, kind of it's thing. A little bit like Lost as well. Like, you know, when Lost started, it was like, gripping cliffhanger. And then you got cliffhanger fatigue. Every episode, it was a cliffhanger that wasn't ever really properly resolved. Or at least I lost interest in the show before most of the
And that is the writers going, trying to refine down too much. Like, let's, you know, just the cliffhangers. People love cliffhangers. And it's like, it's a bit like, you know, that meme, like, you tell your mum one time you like eagles. And then there's a picture of, like, this knight on a horse with blazing with the eagles coming out everywhere kind of thing. It's a little bit that, right?
Yeah, yeah. I remember a kid at school was like, he said his mum told his mum he liked apple juice, and like then that's like the only thing she bought for like weeks.
Yeah, exactly.
And also, I think going back to the graphics card thing is you've got to, like, especially these times more so than ever, you got to look at what's value for money. And if you play, like, for myself, there maybe is less than half a dozen, much actually like one or two AAA games that I'm interested in playing. That's not worth the graphics card.
I can't even think of the last AAA game I played, but there are the odd graphically intensive indie games. For example, War Tales is very, very, very good and quite demanding. Mm. It's not super, super demanding, but it's taxing my current card a little bit. But it's playable.
Eastwatch. Is it Eastwatch, the friendly anime game?
I've not played it, but yeah.
I feel like in order to get the enjoyment out of the game, you do need the graphics up to ultra, because it's very atmospheric storytelling with a very... You know, you need the soft light and the whole atmosphere. You know, it's a very basically it's a not quite a walking simulator, but it's near it, right? Like it's very mundane level quests, because you're to get the idea is to get you just immersed in this very soft, very wholesome world.
There are certain games where the graphical fidelity is part of the game. It is inherent and core. Yeah, for sure. But yeah, that there's something I wanted to talk about, actually, which is I've been leaning. Okay, so there's a particular kind of game that I really enjoy, which is the very small team, usually one person thing, that's made like as a labor of love, right? Mm-hmm. Like they'd be making this game whether one person bought it or zero people bought it or a million people bought it. Like they have this game in them that they want to make, right?
Yeah.
And usually those games have, in inverted commas, like terrible graphics. Like quite often it's code or art or, you know, just very cheaply bought stock art or, you know, that kind of thing. Cause that's all, you know, all they could do, all they can afford or they don't care about the graphics. And it's come to the point where I see games with terrible graphics and I'm like, oh, that's going to be a good game. Cause it's like, if your graphics are that bad, like the gameplay must be amazing.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I quite like where they've been, like, because I quite like a visually good-looking game, but that doesn't necessarily mean high-fidelity, super, like, realistic graphics, but, like, a nice style. So...
Yeah, no, this is... I know what you're talking about, and I appreciate that too. Like, Hades, for example, being an example of that.
Hades,
like, it's
a perfect
gorgeous,
example.
Right?
Yeah.
But no, I'm talking about games that
you're talking about Tales of Hood.
Right. I've got a few examples, right? These are games. I'll start off with the one I've not actually played this. I really want to play it. I've watched many hours of video of it being played. It's a little bit too expensive at the moment. It's called Card Survival Tropical Island. Mm-hmm. If you want to have a look at that on Steam, it's quite clearly all of the assets in the game are drawn by the one developer. Mm-hmm. But this game is... Okay, there's three kind of games that I really hate at the moment, and that it's crafting, survival, and roguelites. And this is a crafting, survival, roguelite, right? But it looks amazing. It's just card. The UI is card based. Like everything is represented by cards. You're stuck on a tropical island, and you have to survive. And you interact with the world by just dragging cards onto things. So you have a card for a stone, and you drag it onto a palm tree, and you throw the stone at the palm tree, and a coconut falls down, and you know, drag the stone onto the coconut, and you crack the coconut open, that kind of thing, right?
That looks fun, actually. That's
it's so deep, and I think what it does beyond any game I've ever seen is because we've played a lot of games, and we're programmed. We know how games work, and we know they don't work like real life, right? And when you see somebody new to games playing a game, they try and do all the things that make sense in real life but don't work in games. And because we know that those things won't work, it's kind of a shame. Like we've kind of lost that sense of like immersion, really. Do you know what I mean? But this game is like the exception. Things that would, you know, it's not 100%, of course, but things that would make sense in real life, things you want to try in real life, they work in the game. And that's kind of amazing. And it's kind of sad that is amazing.
It's hypnotic to watch. And it look, yeah.
Yeah. You see what I mean about that? I mean, the art, nobody's going to say that is good art, right? It's not good art, but does it matter?
I appreciate that it's like, you know exactly what's on the screen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It kind of reminds me a little bit of your city builder game, your Sim Cities and such, City Skylines, where it's like you can just bulldoze a block of flats to put a road through it, which obviously is something that you could, it would be unfathomable to do in real life. Or just the idea of like, I just want to build a flat there, but I also want to build a road. Because like it assumes that the same people that build the flats build the roads, which obviously is not the case. Like you're some sort of, like, not even a dictator, like some sort of, like, civic god, you know, like
city planning god, the god of
city planning god, yeah,
god of roundabouts.
Yeah, it's, yeah, it, I mean, the absurdism in games is interesting, I suppose, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, yeah, but no, like you say, like, just to go a little bit like pretentious arty, I think games trying to look good, as in, because it. I think what it really is that this game is not tasteful. It's like the designer doesn't know the rules of design, right?
Yeah.
But those rules of design, really, they're kind of bourgeois, right?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, and this is more like folk art. And to tell this game that it's ugly is a little bit like, it makes me realize how far mass culture has been gentrified. I won't go too far with that, but do you know what I'm saying, right? Kind of nice to see this almost like cottage industry games where like they, it's like, fuck your bourgeois aesthetics, I'm just drawing this in paint.
It's rebelling, and you know, yeah. I mean I suppose a little bit about our logo, innit, you know, it's
exactly, yeah. I mean, I think that's done more consciously, but yeah,
yes, well, I mean, sort of. I mean, when I did the little logo in the middle of the flag, it's slightly off to the left, which almost I deliberately did to annoy me, like it's like it's slightly off to the left, but you know what, I'm like, that was a first attempt done in 5 minutes,
yep, and that's the point, and
that's kind of the point. And
like, would it matter? Like, we could send that to a design agency and pay them £5,000 to do that logo in a black, like, would it matter? Would anybody care?
Exactly. It's just like, and it's clear, you can I was gonna say you could put it on a t-shirt. I don't want this to be the kind of podcast that has t-shirts. I hate the type, you know.
Yeah.
My favorite podcasts don't have t-shirts. If you want to do a t-shirt or any memorabilia, just make it yourself.
Yeah.
You know, it's fine.
So our t-shirts will be the last food thing that you ate that has like a sticky label. Pull the sticky label off and put it on a t-shirt.
Yes, bingo. So we're going to get a lot of Del Monte t-shirts.
Do things even have sticky labels now? They kind of like, back in the day, a jar of jam had like a sticky label that you could peel off, right? Mm. Now they have like these sticky labels that are like welded to them, and if you peel them off, it just rips it and the glue isn't sticky anymore. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm, it's like, sure, Granny. You get Granny Smith. They still put labels on apples.
That's
right?
True. Yeah, fruit. You get stickers on fruit for some reason, because you need to know what brand that banana is.
Yeah, yeah. It's do something like that. Like, you know, no Patreon. No, what's the other one? Ko-fi,
We don't even know. Oh, the other kind of t-shirt I'll accept is one made with a Dymo.
A Dymo.
You know those printy label things where you turn the dial and get the letter and go.
Oh yes.
Yeah, but the old ones, not the digital ones, the old fashioned ones.
Mm-hmm. Or just get a t-shirt and just draw on it. You can just draw on it. Just be like, I like boats, or like I like, because that's what a t-shirt basically is, right?
Free butter.
Yeah, free. Yeah,
I've got a list. A short list of games with inverted commas terrible graphics that I've really enjoyed lately, and I'm just gonna rip through them, okay?
Sure.
So, Erronorth Chronicles. That's two N's in Erronorth. Erronorth Chronicles is imagine Slay the Spire mechanics, but in an open world RPG like Morrowind.
Ooh.
Made by one person. It's got literally thousands of cards, and it gets updated quite frequently, and the updates will usually be like, I've added 800 more cards. it's absurd. Like all the graphics are like stock art pulled from like stock art places, and it mismatched in styles, but it's a really great, because I wanted a card combat game that wasn't roguelike, because I'm really sick of roguelikes. I want to feel like a sense of continual progress. And it delivered. That's a great game. Intergalactic Fishing.
Okay. It's
another with very rudimentary artwork, which actually has a really nice style to it. This one's a little bit different. And that's kind of what it sounds like. You go fishing and you teleport to lakes on other planets and go fishing. It's pretty great. Low Magic Age. I think this one's Chinese. Whoever makes D&D, is it Wizards of the Coast? Like they release some of their old rules under a license that allows people to use them freely or something, right? I've probably got the details of that wrong, but there's something along those lines. And this is a turn-based combat-y party RPG, again, in an open world with there's no plot or anything. You just go around an open world doing quests and grid-based, turn-based combat with those rules. Like, it's very D&D-ish. That's really fun. Yeah. My favorite game currently, Dead Grid.
Dead Grid.
This is another single-person project, Dead Grid. It's a card-based, turn-based, combat-y zombie survival game. But again, it's not roguelike. It's continuous progress. And this one, Rob, it's not really... The art in this one is like quite well done, but it looks like 20 years out of date. Yeah. And there's some choices like... you combine items in this game to make better items, right? Kind of rudimentary crafting. And when you do that, a little animation of like a dude dressed in combat armor like hammering away at something, and then the text like clink clunk clonk comes up on screen, and it's it's so like amateurish, but it's so charming. This game oozes charm, but like very amateur charm, like an honest charm. And it's also a really great game. And that's my list. I didn't want to go on and on and on about games, but those are four amazing games, all made by single people, I think, and with in different ways. Unusual graphics.
Fantastic. Wonderful. Some of those are really good. Interestingly enough, actually, I've been watching video game streamer on YouTube, because those are still a thing, right? Because like most video game players on YouTube, I know, have moved over to Twitch, which has for like people with like small communities, that kind of like makes a little bit of sense. But I've been watching a somewhat larger-ish YouTuber called Many a True Nerd play through Oblivion for the first time, the fourth Elder Scrolls game. And it's kind of a phenomena to watch, because they're like discovering for the first time things that I was discovering when I was a teenager.
Is it their first Elder Scrolls game?
They play Skyrim.
Okay, so they got some.
But not Morrowind.
Right, yeah. So they're going
backwards. And he already says that it's like it's better than Skyrim. And I've not actually played Skyrim, because whenever I want to play an Elder Scrolls game, I tend to pick up Oblivion.
You've never even given Skyrim a pop.
I think I've played through the bit where the dragon comes down and sets everything on fire, and then it goes, okay, go to the place, the main city or something like that. Like once you've done the training level, I've drifted away from it. It just doesn't, I don't know what it is exactly, but it hasn't hooked me. Mm-hmm. And when I get that itch to play an Elder Scrolls game, I go back to Oblivion or I go back to Morrowind.
Yeah, for sure.
And I'm really looking forward to the next OpenMW release, actually. I think I might do some videos on that. But watching them rediscover it, and they've come around, and they say that Oblivion is actually better than Skyrim themselves, giving me even less reason to go to Skyrim now. So
I mean, it is unarguably better than Skyrim. Yeah, I mean, Skyrim is obviously better in terms of like graphical fidelity and all that kind of stuff. But it's in every way that counts for a game, it's worse. It just is.
Absolutely. But it's it is kind of like endearing to watch, and it's kind of interesting to watch. So they're about our age, So they've played a lot of games in that era and are very fond of games in that era. So it's the sort of the graphics, the style of gameplay, the style of quests and all that kind of stuff. It's going to be somewhat familiar to them because it's similar to like your Fallout 3s and your Fallout New Vegas a little bit. Like they're both Bethesda-y games, although New Vegas is of course Obsidian. But I don't know, like I I'm finding that to be like really quite, I don't know, like fascinating and really kind of like
I love watching people discover things that are games that I hold dear or something like that. Like watching somebody experience it for the first time is so joyous, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So it's Yeah, I'm having a great time with that. Actually, since we're on the subject of games, do you want to talk about Stadia? Because it's no longer with us. Well, it's on the way out.
What a
few
surprise.
surprised.
It's
a,
I
a
said
little.
We talked about Stadia a lot, like round about its launch, right? Because we all tried it. I think you took to it quite a lot. I liked it, but didn't really have a reason to use it. But what I said at the time is Google are not doing any of the things that you would do if you wanted this to be a success. Like, and I compared it to Epic, like Epic, bribing a bunch of developers to be exclusive on their platform, giving a lot of games away for free. Those are the kind of things you would do if you want something to take hold, right? Their choice to not do, I think they should have done like a Game Pass kind of thing where you pay a subscription and you get access to, this catalog of 200 games or whatever. Don't understand why they didn't do that. Don't understand why they didn't do freebies and deep sales and stuff. They didn't do any of that. So of course,
There
nobody
was
really had any
more of
reason to
that
use.
towards the end. Not as much as there needed to be. I think one of the big hurdles, I mean, there are so many things they did wrong. Because I think as an actual service itself was great, and I think it had the potential to be so much more than it was. But the fact that just to sign up, I actually went through on a separate account, signed up for a whole new Stadia account to see what the sign up process was, because I got on board so early that it was different. So I wanted to see what's it like if I was to recommend it to someone today. And what you have to do, or what you had to do, was sign up for the trial for the pro account for a month and then cancel it. It was there were so many like unnecessary steps to actually get to you playing a game that I could easily see people just not bothering. It was it, what they should have done. You go to stadia.com and it goes, "Are you new here? Just pick a game and throw you in it for a, I don't know, like a couple of hours trial, just to be like, you know what, try it out." That would have been a
And if you do
start.
like it, if you sign up, pick one of these five games for free.
And like have a couple of free, just have a couple of freebies that maybe you don't even need to sign up to Google for. Just like visit the site, like YouTube. Make it the YouTube of games. Make it so that you just, how you can watch a YouTube video without signing into YouTube. Play a Stadia game
Oh
without
God,
signing into Stadia.
imagine the YouTube of games like being like Itch. Do you know what I mean? Like indie developers just throw their games on there and you can try them all out. Like just like an arcade of like hundreds of free games from indie developers you can give a go.
But and Google have the money and the infrastructure to do that. And yeah, and I don't like that. How long did they run YouTube as a loss leader? Decade, well, not decades, but like years.
Is it profit? I mean, do we know that it's profitable now? I know Twitter isn't, is it? Twitter never became profitable. I know
No,
that's not good.
I think well, I'll Google. Oh, Google it.
Google
It might give me biased results in this case. But is
it.
YouTube
You
profitable?
good, Google.
Yeah. YouTube has reported more than a 30% revenue growth in the past 4 years. It's generated 28.8 billion in 2021, a
Oh.
46% increase on 2020 figures. So it's
Imagine, right? Imagine if that were nationalized and all that went to the people who make the videos.
yeah. That's quite yeah. So it's I think I mean that's a big jump in profits actually. What are they doing? Are they just hammering the adverts more? Because YouTube to me doesn't seem like it's growing.
Does it coincide maybe with when they offered the thing where you can pay to not be advertised to?
No, I think that was earlier,
No. Okay.
and I don't think that many people picked it up really. I think they're keeping that as a bit of a niche
I
thing.
hear more than you would think, and they probably don't need that many. Like, because the number of YouTube users is insane, right? If you get 1% of that, that's probably an absolute megaton of money.
I mean, if I didn't have Adblock, I would probably pay for it. So,
I occasionally because I sometimes I alternate between using Firefox and Qt browser, right? I really like Qt browser, but the thing that stops me using Qt browser is the videos on YouTube specifically, honestly. Sorry, the adverts on YouTube specifically, because anyway, doesn't matter why. I can get around that by watching the videos with MPV, which you can launch kind of seamlessly and stuff like that. But like, sometimes you just want to like click on a video and watch it in your browser, right? So there's no kind of ad blocking that is necessary to block ads doesn't exist in Cute Browser. And every now and then it'll pop up that, like, do you want a free trial of whatever they call their thing where you don't get ads? And I'm so tempted to click it, but I know if I click it, like, it's got to be so hard to go back on. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. And that's why they do it, of course. So yeah, I've always resisted clicking it. I would never, and it's kind of odd, like, how much I resent. Because YouTube is an amazing service. Like, honestly, YouTube is kind of phenomenal. Like, you can, anybody can upload videos of any length. You know, I assume there's an upper limit, but reasonably any length. And anybody in the world, you know, assuming your country allows it, anybody in the world can watch that video. That is kind of phenomenal. I should have more love for it than I do, but I don't. I kind of, if they ask for me for money, I resent that. It's like, no, because you're an incredibly wealthy corporation, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, 28.8 billion in 2021.
Yeah. You know, if I was watching PeerTube and they were like, you know, can you drop us a fiver? Yeah, sure. Yeah, of course. Yeah, I'll help out. But, like, you should know. I don't care what you're giving me for free. No.
They're making lots of money. I think part of the magic of YouTube.
My point is that, like, they're not making money from me because I'm neither signing up nor watching the ads, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. But do you feel that it's, like, it doesn't feel like it's growing, though. It feels like, particularly with a lot of stuff, like, and I might be wrong on the figures on this one, but I'm literally only going from a feeling from, like, you know, what people make reference to and all this kind of stuff in popular media. But, like, Twitch seems to be getting the edge on the streaming, and TikTok seems to be getting the edge on the vlogging slice of life type of stuff.
I think that's a little bit your bubble. I think. There's a kind of video that doesn't make sense either on TikTok or Twitch, and that is still on YouTube. I mean, I spend, like, too much time watching YouTube.
Right? Me too, for sure. But it feels,
being nibbled away at, but I think it's still, you know, if you want to upload, you know, medium or long videos, it's still the only option, really. You know, for normal people, it's the only option.
For sure. But also there's a part of me that feels a little bit like it's of our generation. Not sort of like, are Zoomers going to be as into YouTube as we are?
I honestly think so, yeah. I know what you mean, and that's definitely the case with Facebook, right? Which isn't even our generation, it's almost our parents' generation, right?
Pretty much, even me,
who's older than you. Twitter, I think Twitter is probably, it's the case for Twitter for the Zoomers, right?
Do you mean more millennials? I think YouTube.
Sorry?
Would you say, I would say Twitter's maybe a little more millennial than Zoomers.
No, I'm saying I can't see the Zoomers using Twitter, like, long term.
No, yeah.
Yeah. But I think YouTube, I mean, just, you know, like gaming videos and I don't know what there is on YouTube. I don't know what the young people watch, but I think YouTube is basically, Not like directly, of course, but it's essentially television, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it is the default.
It feels like television, for sure. How do you feel about, like, where do you think podcasts are going? Do you think podcasts are of our generation, or do you think they're going to be cross-generation?
I think podcasts are... I was actually talking to somebody about this the other day. I think podcasts are huge, right?
Yeah.
But because it's interesting... Because there's no corporation that does, you know, that has taken over podcasts and made it, you know, a named product, you don't hear about them much. You hear about a particular podcast, you know, in various places, but you don't hear about, you know, in the way that you hear about YouTube or, you know, Twitch is streaming, YouTube is video content, Twitter is whatever that is. There's no place that is podcasts. They're a bit like the old internet, right? They're just something that people do and put out there and other people listen to. And there's no middleman. And I know you can host your podcast on iTunes, and I think they've collected or captured a lot of that podcast listening. But I think those podcasts could detach themselves from iTunes, you know, overnight, which isn't the case of these other services. So yeah, I don't think any corporation has managed to capture podcasts, and that's kind of great. And what I'm rambling away at trying to get at is, you know, Netflix owns, you know, TV, well, less so than you used to, but TV and movies, right? So you hear about how many, you know, how many users, how many hours. You don't hear about that with podcasts. We don't know how many, you know, we do from other mechanisms, but it's a massive, massive audience. I think they're almost like the default form of entertainment. You know, if somebody's got a car journey, it's either music or podcasts, right? Yeah. Or, you know, if you've got a lazy afternoon while you're playing a game, it's podcasts. I think that was really rambly, but I think podcasts are absolutely huge, but we just don't hear about it.
Yeah, because you can't put it into easily into a chart, or, you know. And, yeah, and also, like, for example, with what we're doing here, like, if you wanted to share this podcast, you could probably download it and just, like, shoot it into a WhatsApp message to someone. You know,
yeah.
And I kind of like that's one of the sort of the reasons why I like the idea of opting for it to be an audio podcast. In so far that, like, I like the idea of, yeah, like, people could literally just download it and save it, or people could give, you know, like, give it away, share.
You know what I mean
it
about it feeling more like old internet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And I like that.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah,
like, I think literally hundreds of thousands of people just making radio shows for each other. There's something kind of like charming about that.
Yeah, because I think I romanticize a little bit of shortwave radio. I know that shortwave radio is rubbish, but and it's like
it was weird was what was great about it, right?
Yeah, and I mean it's still a thing, but
yeah,
like it's not accessible to listen to, and it's not accessible to make content for.
Yeah.
I like that it exists theoretically, but in reality, if you wanted a indie type of technology that was accessible, just make an MP3. Even the like audio editing software Audacity, like, you know, free, open source, and accessible to everyone, right? Like, a lot of times when I watch streamers on Twitch who have nothing to do with the free software world, I'll see the little Audacity logo in their taskbar. You know, it's
Yeah, for sure. Even the pro, the big huge podcasts. Yeah. And I would say, like anybody, not quite anybody, but if you've got a rubbish laptop, if it's got a microphone, you can make a podcast. And don't buy into this thing that you need like pro grade like microphones and stuff. Undoubtedly, people will complain about your audio quality, but that's just a thing people seem to like doing. You're perfect. Yeah. You're understandable, and that's all that matters. If I can listen to you and understand what you're saying, and you're saying something interesting, I'm going to listen, and it's great.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's it. Yeah. And good enough is good enough, really. Right. Like, as long as it's not grating.
Yeah. I mean, you don't want like in the background or anything like that, but as long as it's, you know, fairly clean.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
You don't want somebody's squeaky ass chair in the background. That'd be awful.
Yeah. And I mean, like, you know, one of the goals we're going for is like the whole low fidelity thing. It's like going back to what we were talking about with Macs. Like, I was thinking the other day, Macs are everything I dislike about the computer world, right? I'm not having like a go at people that use Macs. Use whatever you want, is, you know, I don't care. But like, to me, like, the reason I'm in free software and Linux and all that kind of stuff was because when I started out on my computer journey, when I got given my first computer that was mine, like, my first computer was like a family computer that we all shared and all that kind of stuff. But when I went to university, I got given a secondhand laptop, and I was like, oh, this is great. This is like my first, my computer. And I couldn't afford a Windows license. So I was legitimately just thrown into Linux. I had to learn Linux. I knew it existed. I played with it before, but I was like, I can't realistically, I'm about to start a new life in a different city. I need every penny I can.
Yeah.
I'm going to go and I've always wanted to learn Linux. So this was like, you know,
just out of interest, why did you not pirate Windows, which is, you know, what everybody did back then?
Because I always felt, and the same reason I don't like pirate Photoshop or anything like that, is I always felt like there was going to be a time when that option was cut off and all of the skills I learned had disappeared.
That's true. Yeah.
It might very well be the case now. I don't know, like, because Windows seems to be this always online thing, which is kind of the reason I don't think I'll ever go back to it now, is because I don't like the idea of an always online operating system.
I there are many, many reasons why at this point I would never, ever, 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 ever go back to Windows.
Yeah.
Never. I just could not.
It's
if it was a choice between Windows or a Commodore 64, I'm on the Commodore 64.
Yeah, yeah. Like if
I think that's almost true.
Yeah, for sure. Like if Linux went away tomorrow and I couldn't make a BSD or a Haiku or something like that work, I just wouldn't be interested in computers anymore. Like,
because
things like non-free software, to me, they're products, right? Like, it might as well be a toaster or something like that. It's something that a corporation has made and has sold to me. I have no say in its creation. I have autonomy.
I will say, I know you, I think you hate Macs far more than I do. Like, I would never buy one myself just because they're so expensive for the hardware, right? Like, you can get a much better non-Mac laptop for the same money, or a good one for less money. But if I wasn't paying and my choice was a Windows laptop or a MacBook, without a shadow of a doubt, the MacBook. Because everything you say is right, but underneath all that, it is Unix, and I like Unix.
Or POSIX compliant.
It's literally Unix. It's certified Unix, which Linux isn't.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
I can ignore all the Apple stuff. I can run Vim. You know, I can run all the things, all the terminally things I want to run. You can even replace the window. You can use Linux window managers if you want to. I don't know if I'd bother with that, or just, you know, use it. I would treat it more as an appliance if I didn't, you know, if I didn't have Linux. A computer would, as you say, just be an appliance to me, and I'd use it as such. It wouldn't be a thing to play with as much. But yeah, I'd be fine. I'd be fine on a Mac because it's, you know, as I say, because it's Unix and I can use all the things I like using.
Yeah, but also the thing with Macs is that they're prohibitively expensive to me. Like they're not designed to be customizable. They're incredibly expensive.
Although, again, I'm gonna. This is a little bit devil's advocate rather than something I firmly believe. But again, I've got a friend. She has a MacBook that was secondhand when she got it, so which puts it, I think, probably cheaper than a Windows laptop at the time. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly old now, and I think if you compared that to a non-Mac laptop, I want to avoid saying a Windows laptop because there's no such thing as a Windows laptop, right? Mm. Just laptops. If you compare it to a Windows laptop of the same age, it's far more capable.
For sure. But I kind of feel that, like, Mac have they like to control their stuff, right? They like their walled gardens. They like their own little paradigms. And even that, you know, situation, because I know people as well who were in that very similar situation. They get secondhand Macs. The idea that, like, it's, you're supposed to use it a certain way, right? You're supposed to update every so often. You're supposed to take it to the Mac Genius store to get it fixed, right? Like, you know, you're not supposed to do so many things with it, lest it void warranty. And it just feels like, sure, we can talk about the technical aspects of it. We can talk about the fact that their UI probably doesn't have adverts like Windows does and all this kind of stuff. But it does kind of feel like Macs, just, they're not designed for people like me, right? That, like, I feel like an unwelcome guest in the Mac house.
No, for sure. I understand that. Yeah, yeah. You're a squatter.
Yes, yes. Like, I'm like a working class person at a hoity-toity fancy dinner. Do you know what I mean? Like, like the Titanic. I feel like Leonardo DiCaprio, but maybe a little bit more handsome and less of a perv.
How would you feel about, like, a secondhand MacBook running Linux?
I'm fine. Like, the actual hardware itself.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
I actually like Mac keyboard. The little flat, they're lovely to type on.
That's the thing. The hardware is generally really nice, right? The occasional misstep. I think that's sometimes overstated, but, like, they had nice trackpads way before non-Mac laptops had nice trackpads.
Yeah, for sure. I don't like the iPhones on the basis that, and please correct me if I'm wrong on this, you can't sideload apps. Everything has to come through the apps.
No, you can't. Yeah, I've got a hand-me-down iPhone. It's my sister's old one that she just gave to me when she got an upgrade, right? And I got to say, like, I do prefer iOS to Android, but you can't sideload. But I know when I had an Android phone, I never did sideload because I don't, I guess, I mean, it helps that I'm not mobile, right? I don't go anywhere. But like the things I do on a phone, I don't need to sidelight. I don't care about, I care about my computer because it's where I live. I don't care about the phone. And I think iOS is a bit better than Android. I think they're effectively the same thing at this point, but iOS is a little bit smoother and seems to run on like the hardware specs, I think, are lower on iPhones for equivalent performance.
That's interesting, but yeah, I mean, I can certainly believe that. I've never used an iPhone in my life, but the and I don't like, I'm not a big carer of the mobile space because your choices are Google and Apple.
Yeah,
who's going to get excited about that? And maybe there'll be a time. I mean, I tried the Fairphone with EOS on it. That was actually pretty good. No complaints on that one. It was quite a big phone, physically quite big, but
I'm not really super. I know there's, you know, there are movements to get, you know, get a free operating system onto phones and stuff. I think that would be nice, but to me, a phone is an appliance. It is inherently an appliance, so I don't care as much really. I care. I think it's as important. No, this is probably overstating it, but I was going to say it's as important that my phone is open source as my toaster is open source. You know, it's not quite that true because of the importance of phones in people's lives and communication and blah, blah, blah. It's a little bit more important than that. But I don't really care about phones.
The thing is with me is I run Linux on all my machines and I'm very happy with it. But for me, I kind of need my phone to be like compatible with certain apps, like the app that you pay for parking with, the app that you bank with, the app that, you know, like, and I can easily imagine a circumstance where my bank is like, oh, you're on an unfamiliar operating system. That's a security hazard. We're going to lock you out. And I like my, like, as you say, there is an appliance factor to it that it's like, if I need an app for some, we live in a world now where apps are kind of the easiest way to do so many things. My parents, who were quite anti smartphone, ended up getting a smartphone because they wanted to travel with the COVID stuff. So they had to do a COVID passport, all that kind of stuff. You can do it. Technically, you can do it without a smartphone, but it involves sending off stuff in the mail waiting 10 days for something that you could just beep, beep, beep on an app. They felt like they'd lost a battle and it was kind of sad really. And because I also felt that like, I no longer have a smartphone because I want one. I have one because I need one. And I don't like that I feel like I need.
It does make me a bit nervous having like two corporations being in control of something that is that essential to modern life. That is worrying.
And we all know like Google quite regularly just close people's accounts because they, for honestly, no solid reason other than they trigger an algorithm.
Yeah.
Oh, you're using a VPN? You must be up to something shady. Shut you down. And the thing we saw this actually with Terraria, the game.
Yeah,
they had when they were developing for Google Stadia, their developer account just got shut down.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah,
15 years of work, and their developer account got shut down. Now they managed, because it was such a media storm, they managed to get their account back up and running. Your average person on the street is not going to have that same kind of clout. So, what happens if I, for some reason, become ineligible? For a Google account. What if they decide that they want to close it down I've got no recourse? I've got no recourse because I didn't, like, I mean, what do, right? Like, does that lock me out of society because Google don't like me? Do I have to buy Apple stuff for the rest of my life? What happens if Apple just make a mistake and close my account? What if, mistakes happen? We live in a, you know, imperfect world where mistakes just happen. And you can, by mistake, slip through the cracks and get cut out of society.
I think this is going to change if corporations get their way. But we are still at the point where, as far as Google is concerned, you're actually pseudonymous, right? They don't actually know. I mean, they do algorithmically, but, like, legally speaking, they don't know who you are. So you could just set up a new Google account, right? I'm sure there's going to come a point where that changes and it's tied to something that you can't change. But for now, at least.
I mean, I'd be interested to test that hypothesis under like things like, well, what happens if you've got a Stadia account and you've bought £200 worth of games? Well, obviously, Stadia.
Yeah. Oh yeah, no, that would be lost. But I do know for a fact that my Google account, because they keep asking me to tie it to a phone number or something like that, right? And I've always refused. So my Google email address is the last link in the chain. It doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't point to anything else. So I definitely could set up a new Google account. But as I say, that's not an argument against what you're saying. That's going to change. They're going to want to pin it to something that is identifiable at some point.
Yeah.
And that's why we need to resist.
Yeah. It's remarkable that we live in a world where everything's so app-centric, and Google and Apple they're the absolute unquestionable gatekeepers. Is it a failure of policy? Like, I can imagine like the European Union possibly eventually coming around to some kind of, because they have called out, they've called out Android for the Android, were Android at one point going to get rid of sideloading apps, and then the European Union stepped in and say,
I remember reading that. I can't remember the details, but something along those lines. Yeah, I mean, the European Union clearly lean a bit more in the right direction than some of the rest of the world, but I think the problem, you know the cookie thing on websites?
Mm-hmm.
And what an absolute pain in the arse that is.
Yeah.
I think that's the kind of, I wish they were a bit more, because obviously in making that decision to say that, you know, if a website serves you cookies, they have to tell you exactly what cookies they're serving you and give you a mechanism for opting out, blah, 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 blah. And of course, the corporations are going to make that as inconvenient as possible because they don't want you to do that. What they should have done in making that law, what they were recognizing is that these cookies are anti-consumer. They're bad, right? Mm. They are an attack on people. So if they recognize that, why not just make them out illegal? That's my problem with like the EU solution to things. They recognize that these things are harmful, but they didn't want to upset the corporations that much. So they said, you just got to tell people you're doing it, knowing full well that they would just make that as inconvenient as possible. They should have just said, you're not allowed to do this. I think that's the kind of solutions you're going to get from the EU. They're going to be half-assed, wishy-washy, and you know, that law has made my life less convenient. I kind of preferred it when it was just accepting all the cookies by default, and I could set it in the browser, you know, the security level of that, which sites can of course ignore. I'm aware of that, but it's such a pain in the ass when you visit a new site now and the pop-in. And if you choose not to accept the cookies, you get that every time you visit that site.
Yes.
There is a browser add-on which deals with many of them automatically, but it stalls you. You can't use the page until that's done doing its thing. It really is. I mean, it's a tiny thing. It's a first world problem, without a doubt, but it is a pain.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, and but it's the best we got. You know, like they do things like they standardize they do that thing where they standardize phone charges and all that
that is all good stuff. I just wish they go a bit further, which
and I fully agree with that, but also to go as far as we would want to go would probably be unrealistic, right?
For sure, but I think there's a point where we'd be like, we'd recognize that's as far as they can go, and they're not there, right? I understand they are and how far they can go, and I think they can go a bit further than they are.
They can go a lot further, yeah. But and I think they may get there. Like, they seem to be drifting in the right direction, but also, like, when we talk about the European Union, it's such a complex... if you call it an institution, really, because you've got different segments pulling against each other all the time. The one thing I can tell you with, because I have an international politics degree, and the one thing I can tell you about all this kind of stuff is, if you think it's complicated on the surface, it's 10 times complicated underneath. There's no such thing as a simple solution.
I mean, for starters, there are 100, you know, the question, what is the EU? There are 100 answers to that.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, 100 true answers is my point.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And, they trend in the right direction, but also, like, you know, they are balancing, you know, I mean, in terms of as a political institution, they're kind of like liberal capitalist, right?
Yeah. I mean, then it's a neoliberal. I mean, one of the answers to the question, what is the EU, is it's a way for Germany to abuse poorer countries through through controlling their currency, right? What Germany did to Greece, and it was the EU, but you know, Germany really, that was inexcusable. Thousands of people died because of that. Yeah. And that's one of the things that the EU is, and you know, there's other things that EU are that I admire greatly. You know, the Convention on Human Rights, a lot of the cooperation stuff, amazing, love it.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
anybody who's entirely pro or anti EU is not thinking about it hard enough, because it is incredibly complicated.
It's one of the most complicated things that we have. You know, like and. So, you know, even us British people who are allegedly Brexited from it all, we're not, like, because the thing is, it's not like we've moved the island away from the mainland Europe. Like there's still going to be trade that needs to be done. There are still going to be, like...
Well, still, I was wondering, when you said that they're drifting in the right direction, I was wondering, like, how much of that is because we left. Well, stop pulling them in the wrong direction.
Yeah, and well, we still have, like, I imagine we still have, like, what, 800,000 British people living in Spain or something like that, like, and also, of course, what they do is going to impact us. We've just withdrawn our representation from it, so it's but anyway, that aside, for sure that if I phones, that's where we were, wasn't it?
Can you talk for a minute while I go to the toilet?
I can pause. Would you prefer me to pause? Or we could go to a commercial break. Oh no, we don't have any sponsors. No,
let's do a commercial break. You do a commercial break. I'm going to
All right. Okay, I'll do a commercial break. So have you ever considered getting a home on the Fediverse? It is not one place, but actually thousands of places that are hosted on many computers by many people. It's a living, breathing, organic network, a social network, if you will, that is owned and operated by the people who use it. It's not even funded with one mechanism. It's not funded through, basically, it's usually crowdfunded, but sometimes people will just have a Raspberry Pi in their house, and that will be a server. Or sometimes they'll just do it on Amazon, or sometimes they'll do it on DigitalOcean. And it's and they all talk to each other, and you can and have fun and share memes. And
look, Chris, how much does this cost?
However much depends what server you're on. Maybe they might ask for a Patreon contribution, or maybe they might just be. Yeah, well, Toot.Wales is actually funded by grant money, which is kind of nice.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, so, but some will ask for a Patreon donation. Some will just be sponsored by a company or an organization, or several. And
Fediverse is great, isn't it?
Fediverse is great. That was terrible. I'm going to cut. I think I might cut.
No, it's great. I loved it. But I was gone a little bit too long and you ran out of things to say, but that was great.
Yeah. And actually, you know, the Fediverse is about 10 years old.
Is it really?
If you go back to the precursor to GNU Social.
Do you know what else is about 10 years old? I'm just checking my facts so I can do a cool segue.
Oh.
See if you can get some while I'm finding out.
What else is 10 years old?
Wikipedia is disambiguating me too hard.
Things that are 10 years old. I don't know. Well, 10 years old, 10 years ago was 2012. Oh.
Okay. It's actually 14 years old.
Wikipedia?
Nope. Wayland.
Oh, Wayland.
Wayland is 14 years old. And I mentioned earlier that I got a new graphics card. It's an AMD graphics card. And because it was an AMD graphics card, I was like, I can give Wayland a go, see what it's like. Mm-hmm. I've always had a problem with Wayland's design, the security model, the way they've dealt with security. Trying Wayland is kind of like an illustration of all of those like misgivings. It's everything that I thought would be wrong with it because of that design is wrong with it. Mm. I think if you use GNOME or KDE, I think you're probably fine. You can use Wayland and you won't even know you're using Wayland. It's, you know, all great. But my main problem with it is because it is just a protocol, not, you know, a software, the onus is on, how can I put this simply? Like, every window manager needs to implement everything that a display server should do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and there are common libraries to do this are emerging, but it's just a really inelegant. And also the whole idea that, like, I don't want, you know, Windows, because part of what lets me do the things I do currently is that there's very little security on X, right? Windows can see what each other's doing. Every window can know what the keyboard is doing, regardless of which window is focused, right?
Yeah.
And that would be a security concern. You know, on a phone, you wouldn't want that because you've got all these apps from, you know, completely untrusted. I'm running Linux, and all my stuff is installed from the package manager. And for me, that is enough trust. Like, I'm not installing things from, you know, Google's App Store or Apple's App Store or random websites, right? Every piece of software, I'm going to put games aside for now, but like, every piece of software I run is either compiled by myself from a source that I trust or from the repositories which I trust. You can argue that I'm wrong to trust them, but that's a pretty trustworthy source.
Yeah.
So I think Wayland's design for philosophy, I think, is for phones. That's where it makes sense. And I'm not running a phone. I'm running a PC. So it's just a massive inconvenience for the people making the window managers. And, you know, I've tried some of the smaller window managers running on Wayland, and they all just have problems that stem from this design philosophy. It's just really hit and miss. It's 14 years old, and it doesn't work yet. And that is really disappointing. And I kind of hope that it just dies in something simpler and more just like an X Redux with you know, the modern stuff, yeah, the modern compositing that should be in there.
Yeah.
It's sad.
So what's the thing that you come up against then? What's like the first thing that maybe a layperson would notice if they're...
I think a layperson, if you're running GNOME or KDE, it would be fine. And that, you know, the layperson, that's probably what they're doing. But that kind of illustrates the problem that, you know, the big ones with a ton of resources behind them can deal with all the problems, but like the smaller window managers can't. The smaller window managers, it'd just be... I mean, it was odd, random things that were different on every window manager that I tried.
Yeah.
A lot of it was stuff with games. Like when you run a full screen game, it's literally like a dice roll as to what's going to happen. And certain things just not running. The things that get cited off and all, like things like what you call it. You know, things that show on screen what your keyboard is doing for videos and stuff.
Yeah.
Like that has to be coded by the particular compositor, as in the window manager. Streaming, that has to be coded and implemented in every single window manager rather than handled by something higher up. It's things like that. It's just it's putting such a massive amount of work on the plate of people making, you know, like small window managers.
So it's making developing software basically more prohibitive to.
I think so, yeah. And I honestly think that might be part of its point. I think there's a sort of a cadre of influences within Linux that want that. They want it to be standardized. And it's the sort of the Red Hat GNOME you know, like Triad, or there's another one I can't remember, but I think they want everybody to be on GNOME, everybody using the same applications in the same way, because it makes life easier for developers, right, generally speaking, for sure. But that's not the operating system that I want, right? Yeah. I get the upsides of that, but they're not upsides for me.
Do you think we can live in a world where they coexist?
I think we always will. I think no matter how hard they try to turn Linux into that, there'll always be this rebellious little corner. And I think because they've made Wayland so like prohibitive, I think that corner will be running X, and that might be a problem for the future.
Because X is what, old, clunky, being held together with string and duct tape?
No, just if their goal is like unity, and they want everybody running, and then because of their behavior, half of people are running X and half of people are running Wayland, that makes everything worse for every developer, right? If you've got to deal with both of those.
Well, what take, for example, OBS, which is probably one of the more... No, I was going to say it's more commonly used piece of software. Probably not, actually. But it's certainly a piece of software that a lot of people like having on Linux. Can that ever work in Wayland?
I did manage to get that working in Wayland, but it is, you've got to jump through a lot of hoops. And that, to be fair, that will be smoothed out in the future. But again, the problem with that is, in order to make that work, work has to be done in every single display manager. In every single window, you know, what we now call a window manager. Rather than, you know, on X, that it doesn't care about your window manager. It's talking to X, right?
Yeah.
But because there isn't really a Wayland. Wayland's just the thing that you implement. It's implemented in every single window manager. So every single window manager has to make that mechanism for plugging into OBS and for, you know, polling keyboard and all the other things that you know, X does easily.
Yeah. Okay. So are you going to... So you switch back to X, right?
Yeah. Oh, so before that, I mean, I've tried Wayland before now and then, but not extensively, really. I just had a quick look at it. And I've been suspicious of Wayland. It didn't sound like a good idea. And now, having tried it, and I spent like a good few days making it work as well as I possibly could, I'm now... I would say I'm anti-Wayland. I can't see myself ever using it. Even if for me it works perfectly, I'm aware of like just the terrible design decisions that have gone into that. When X is you know, their claims are that X is complex and, you know, and huge and inefficient and all of these things, but it works great. And from a user point of view, it works very simply.
Yeah, I have now remembered why I don't use Wayland.
Yeah,
I don't use Wayland because I use a VPN and firewall combination that I'm very happy with. And I, like an absolute lame-o, use a GUI to manage my firewall. I use, what is it, GUFW.
Uh-huh.
And you cannot use... last time I checked, it doesn't work on Wayland because you have to run it as root, and Wayland doesn't permit you to run.
Yes, GUIs, it's things like that root that just feel very much like... I get the security argument, of course I do, but as I say, I trust my software because it's coming from the repository first of all, and secondly, I think it's not inherent to the Unix philosophy, but part of Linux culture and Unix culture is your computer does what you tell it to do, and you can tell it to do anything. Like, if you want to run your whole system as root, it's a stupid idea, but you can do it, right? Yeah. And what that Wayland approach feels more like, you know, like iOS, like Android. It's like, no, you can't be trusted. You can't be trusted to make the decisions, you know.
Yeah.
And for less technical users, that might, you know, it's a safer option. I get it. But for me, that's not what I want. I want my computer to do exactly what I tell it, even if it's a terrible idea.
Yeah, for sure. Like it's, yeah. That is the thing I like about Linux in general. You delete something, it gets deleted. You know, you know, what's the?
I don't use a big. RM, you know when you RMFR. Used to be able to do like /rm and just remove your root, right? And they added that thing where you have to pass it an argument now to be able to do that. And there was quite a furore about that. There were people saying, no, this isn't. That's not how this works. If somebody would, you know, tells it to like blah blah, and you know, I don't care about that particular one, but like that's the point, right? If you want to do something stupid,
but there is that meme where it's like, oh, you know, someone's on a forum, please help me, I can't do X, Y, and Z. And I go, it's okay, open up a console, RMFR star or whatever it is.
No, for sure.
And like it's
I would say that's a social problem though. Like that's like somebody, you know, so somebody asking somebody for help, and it's like they say, oh yeah, just get this gun and shoot yourself. Like that's that's the problem. There is not that guns exist, or you know, the problem there is that that person is a very bad person.
For sure, but it's so easy to. I mean, there was a time. I remember many years ago, I was playing something on a game or something, and I was like, oh, do you know what the key combination for this weapon is, or something like that? And someone said, Alt F4. And I just instinctively went, oh, yeah, okay, thank you for that. Alt F4, game closes. It's like, damn, you got me. Yeah. You got me. Like, and there were no stakes involved, nothing, you know, it's just a bit of harmless fun. But even knowing what I knew what Alt F4 did, but I did it anyway out of. We all have off days, you know, and
we're so, inclined to trust each other, which is a good thing, but it costs us sometimes.
I mean, they call it a sanity check, don't they? Where it's just like, are you sure? Like, I just want to let you know what this command is doing, and I go, if you really want to do it.
I mean, that's fine. Yeah, in the case of RM, of course, that is a sensible thing to do. I'm on board, but not to the point where Wayland, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's nuanced, you know, like it's a matter of drawing the line, but I can sort of almost understand why people did kick. I can understand the other side of the argument of in it being the slippery slope type of thing, right? It's like,
yeah,
you know, the nanny state of computers type of thing, you know. It's like, well, well, you know, you won't.
I've got a little bit of a twist to this though, that a really handy FOSS tool, which is kind of related to Wayland. It's called GameScope. Mm-hmm. It's a modification of something that exists on the Steam Deck. Mm-hmm. And its purpose is you can use it for any application, but you can run a game in it, and the game believes that it has sole access to one monitor. Right?
Okay.
So you can use that, and then you have a window that, as far as the program is concerned, is just the monitor, and you can do what you want with that window. So the reason it's handy for games is that there are some games, especially for me on DWM, there's some games that I cannot convince to run at a lower resolution than my monitor. No matter what resolution I set, they'll actually run at the resolution of my monitor, because DWM doesn't baby Windows in the way that some window managers does. So I can use this to run a game at like 1080 in a full screen window. The game thinks it's running at 1080, but it's actually... the game is running at 1080, and then it's being scaled up to my monitor size by GameScope. And it uses that, I can't remember, that AMD FSR, which is that very, very fancy upscaling. Mm. And it's kind of amazing. I've played some games that usually would just look like I've got a 2K monitor, right? It's not huge, but it's 2K. And there are games that would look like a blurry mess if I upscaled them, or, you know, run them at, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But GameScope, it looks, I can't tell that it's not native resolution. It's kind of amazing. One of the uses I've had for it is games with very tiny UI and no UI scaling option. So I'm running them at 1080, and then with this upscaling, you know, viewing them on my 2K monitor, and it's great. It's a really handy, and anything that just misbehaves when it's full screen, you know, there are some games that just don't behave well full screen. Use it for that. It's absolutely fantastic. I'm using it for so many games now, even games that I don't need to. I'm just running at 1080 and upscaling because it looks just as good, and I get more frames.
Yeah,
the reason it's related to Wayland is it's actually using X Wayland. It's actually spawning an X Wayland window. That you know, you could probably do this with X, but like the game believes is the entire monitor kind of thing.
That's interesting.
It's really cool. It's made for the Steam Deck because, of course, they want to, all the things I just described, they want to do that. They want the Steam Deck, they want games to always be full screen, but be able to be different actual resolutions to save battery and stuff, right? So it's, that's why it was made.
I remember when I played the Grand Theft Auto 3 through Wine on multiple monitors, the horrible problem that I had was that it didn't capture the mouse.
Because yes, yeah, yeah, yep, yep.
In the days of GTA 3, I think it was the game. I don't even think it was wine. I think it was the game, because the game just didn't conceive of the idea of people running multiple monitors.
Yeah, no, of course.
It's like, yeah.
Yeah, no, this will be a solution to that. And you can also, you can set the size, you can obviously set the resolution of the monitor that the game sees, and you can also set the size of the, you know, the actual window. Mm. And as I say, this AMD upscaling is really amazing, really crisp. Mm. Yeah, so that would be a solution to that problem for sure.
That's good. Can you control frame rates on it?
In theory, you can. Like, yeah, the instructions on the website say that you can, but it didn't work for me. And that probably most of those things like that end up being because DWM doesn't, you know, plug into those things. But in theory, you can. Yeah, you can control. So a game that doesn't have a frame cap option and doesn't behave well with VSync, you can. Yeah, apparently you can set limit the frame rate with GameScope. It's really handy. It's one of those things that when you hear about it, doesn't sound that handy. Like, I just thought,
I can think of several uses for it off the bat.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm probably using it for about a quarter of the games that I play now for various reasons.
Old games, I think, would benefit from that a lot. I remember on Hitman Blood Money, there is a path you can take on the way out of the first mission, where you're shimmying down a cliff, and for some reason, if your frame rate is too high, you get stuck on a bit.
Right, yeah.
So you, and also that game, like, it ties a lot of things to the frame rate, and including, of all things, the distance bullets fly.
Yeah. I remember a lot of old games would tie, they would use the, because, you know, everybody had a 60 hertz monitor back in the day, right? Why not? Yeah. No, that's not the logic, is it? But still, yeah.
Yeah. Grand Theft Auto Vice City has one as well. I can't remember what it is. But that has a frame limiter in the game. So that's not a
problem. Right, yeah.
But the trouble is with those kind of situations and those kind of games is that it's never, ever, ever obvious that it's the frame rate that's the issue.
Yeah, right.
Like, it's like 47 was getting stuck on the way out of the Blood Money level. And it's like, what's going on? Like, there is nothing that would, any logical, conceivable, like, interpretation of that is, oh, the frame rate's too high.
Yeah.
It's almost one of those things you need a little notice on the wall saying, look, is a game from the mid-2000s playing up? It might very well be that the frame rate is too high. You can turn on a VSync and then it fixes it, but you get, and of course there's UI scaling, which that would be
this tool, actually, obviously it's designed for games, but I was curious as to whether I could just run arbitrary applications inside it. I tried that, and you can I just opened my terminal inside GameScope, which just looks very, very strange, but it works. So I'm sure that, like, people could probably come up with, like, clever things to do with this.
And it looks like it's released under the BSD2 clause license.
That's cool. That's a good license.
Super,
super handy tool.
That's kind of awesome. Wow, good to know that one, actually. Because to be fair, these days I typically only, or the vast majority of games I play tend to be between 1999 and 2010. That's my. To me, that's my, I don't want to say, like, nostalgia, but that's just, I like that golden era of games. It's when games are simpler.
Yeah, I don't think it's just nostalgia. I think that was, I probably talked about this before, but, like, you know, there was a few games, Morrowind to an extent, Half-Life 1, but Morrowind and Deus Ex, and you got the System Shock just before, and there were games that, like, I'm pretty sure I said this before, but they were the, what's the term that's used for those kind of games now? The something sim. The immersive sim, right?
Immersive sim, yeah.
Where, you know, they were trying to make it, oh God, my brain's completely letting me down. What's the term for emergent stuff, right?
Yeah.
You could manipulate things in ways that hadn't been done in games before.
Yeah.
You could make mechanical choices in ways that hadn't been done in games before. Yeah. And this pointed to, like, a bright future of gaming, but that was actually, and we all thought, you know, oh, games are going to be amazing in, like, 5 years, but they never went further down that path. So it's kind of like, it's a peak in terms of those games. Those are the best examples of those kind of games still, right?
Yeah. And it felt a little bit like, particularly with your Fallouts, your Bethesdas, your open worlds, your Grand Theft Autos, they felt like almost like board games, in that like it gave you like a set of rules, it gave you a world, and you kind of approached it as you wish.
Yeah,
it felt less on rails.
It was more a world. It was a simulated world rather than just a game.
And a lot of it is they're the type of game. Like if you go and watch speedrunners on Twitch or on YouTube, the majority of games are from this era because they have a much wider scope than a lot of games modern. Yeah. Now, not exclusively, and there are many games that are before that era that are speedrunners.
That malleability, like you can try stupid stuff.
Exactly, exactly. And I really kind of love it.
Will make you really fast.
I've recently been having like thinking quite a lot about like how nostalgia can be quite harmful.
I think so. Yeah.
And there's a wonderful example on a local issue. So basically, not in my newspaper catchment area, but in a neighbouring area, there are these ponds. These ponds are formed because of a quarry, basically a quarry. And in order to preserve these ponds, every couple of decades, they need to basically do some maintenance on a dam that costs millions of pounds of generally taxpayer money.
Mm-hmm.
And the Wildlife Association are thinking about dismantling these dams and rewilding the area. It's going to change the landscape a fair bit, but it's going to mean that the entire like area is not going to be preserved by these big old concrete structures that are keeping the water where it needs to be. There's a big campaign to keep it as it is. Because, and if you ask people about this, it's because they'll generally give you basically the same story every time, but their own personal variation of it, which is, when I was a young boy, my dad, my parents, they took me down, they walked in the area, we went fishing there, something, you know, I walked the dog there with my grandmother who's no longer with us and all this kind of stuff. They have this kind of nostalgic connection to it, and that really is their reason for wanting to maintain this dam and keep everything preserved as it is at the cost of a lot of money, like, you know, millions of pounds is not for a local authority to spend on.
Do the dam serve any, you know, is there a reservoir? Do the dam serve any function other than this? Or
No. Like the Wildlife Association, they think that it's best if it's just taken back.
Okay.
Because what they want to do is take it back to what it was before it was a quarry, almost. So if you want to go, you know, if you want to apply the very basic logic of older is better, then you would want to rewild it because that's the more natural way of doing things.
I've never been comfortable with nostalgia and that kind of thing, because I'm not saying it's always, I'm not saying they necessarily overlap, but there's kind of a fine line between nostalgia and being reactionary, right?
Yes, there certainly seem to be a big link. Like, I mean, if you look at like your typical gammon, right? Your typical old man Jeremy Clarkson type of person, they have these ways of just clinging on to the past and over romanticizing the past doesn't seem healthy. Sorry.
Yeah. There's a fat streak in American politics of like romanticizing the 50s, right?
Yes.
You know, simpler times where we had full employment and the world was easier to understand, all this stuff. And you know, that's all fine unless, you know, but you know, black people couldn't vote. You know, black people in the South had no rights. Women had fewer rights. You're ignoring a lot to get there. And
also I think that in all like honesty, with a real truly critical brain, I think a lot of the bad stuff gets pushed out of your memory and you only remember the good stuff as well.
Of course, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, obviously, like, I mean, we're talking, if you want to go back to the 50s, were women even allowed a credit card without their husband's permission back then? I don't think so, right?
Yeah. And all, I mean, on top of that, the reason why there was full employment is because World War II had just happened.
Exactly,
killed
yes,
a lot.
Yeah.
Right, there's all the technological boom as well, but that was a lot, you know, thanks
also,
to the war a lot. Like, there's a lack of like curiosity about the reasons for these things. It's also you're coming off the back of like the New Deal, a lot of you know, government spending, social government investment. You know, if you want to get something like the 50s, how about you have a lot of like government investment? That might be a way to go.
Well, you know, yes, but it does seem like your right-wing parties seem to have they manipulate that nostalgia as a political weapon, really, don't they? And like South Park have mimicked, you know, they've done a bit with the member berries, you know. It's like I think it's a bit they do it in a much more broader way, but like I think a lot of our political damage is done by this like fetishization of the past, of the old ways, of, you know, wasn't it great when the world was easy to understand, when have all these phone apps and all of the faffing around. But of course, you know, like there are so many other things that come into play. There are 7 billion people on the planet, and by extension, which is, you know, when, which is like, well, like three times as much as there was, you know, several many decades ago, right? So what that brings with it, I mean, how many cars on the road, right? That factor alone, right, makes life different, right? That like you know, and you know, with all things, there's some good, there's some bad, right? But like, how do you manage a society now with this many cars on the road? Like it's difficult.
No, right? I agree. Nostalgia is it can be weaponized by the right in politics for sure. But would you know, if somebody's like into retro gaming, mm-hmm. I mean, you can play old games without being nostalgic, right? You can enjoy old things without being nostalgic. But when they apply nostalgia to it, and there's this kind of this almost pretense that everything was better back in the day, does you know, when it's about games, does it not make you nervous? Because for me, that still makes me a little bit uncomfortable.
It's something it seems I to definitely be, question.
It's kidding yourself, and it's oversimplifying. It's the same pattern, right?
Yeah, but like, I think, okay, so yes, like it is something I'm aware of. It is something that I definitely like. Am I like, well, for example, OpenMW, the Morrowind open source re-implementation. It makes Morrowind better. It makes Morrowind playable on modern hardware in much better ways. It does tweaks, like it fixes some bugs with the spell making system. It gives you a toggle crouch. It does lots of these little things. It makes the game better. So, you know, if it was purely nostalgia, I would probably reject the new additions that they bring onto Morrowind. And just insist on the purity of the old ways.
Obviously, nostalgia and reactionaryism, like purity, is kind of central to that, right? And purity is a very dodgy idea applied politically.
Yeah, exactly. It is definitely something that I question. But also, one thing that I think is also very, 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 very relevant is me enjoying an old film or video game is not impacting someone else's life.
When
you apply it to like politics, then you start dragging other people into the past with you, and that is bad.
Well, I mean, there's also you can enjoy something from the past and be critical of it at the same time.
Well, like, you have to
acknowledge it. I've been watching a lot of old films lately, and you know, like some of the stuff that characters say and do is politically incredibly dodgy, but you still enjoy the film so long as you have that critical layer, right? And you're not saying it's all simple, all films should be like this, you know.
Well, interestingly enough, and I don't imagine you're a fan of the show Friends.
Is it? I think all of those who lived through the 90s have a relationship with Friends, let's say.
Yes.
My girlfriend at the time would watch that show, it seemed like 24 hours a day. So I'm very familiar with Friends, and it's tied to some fond memories, but I don't think it's as good a show as it's sort of remembered to be.
I have watched a few older episodes. Yeah, like I'm not hugely attached to Friends. I like you consider it a phenomena of its time.
Yeah.
There are some episodes that are quite homophobic in Friends.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
God, where the even the plot line itself is pretty has implied homophobia, right?
You don't even need to go back that. Like, I think things from the 2010s are now like surprisingly homophobic. Like episodes of like The Office, for example,
or Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
No, never appealed to me. Not watched it, but yeah,
it's funny but so juvenile, which was where some of the, but with Friends, I was chatting to this with someone the other day, and it was like one of the actual really good things about Friends is that the female characters in it at the time actually were like fleshed out proper characters. They weren't like female caricatures or one-dimensional characters. They were an equal
part of the agency, right? They had agency over their own lives, and
exactly, and that was quite a lot of, like, women in my life have told me, like, they say, yeah, that was quite like a big deal for them, because before then women were like the wives of the main character husband. All this kind of stuff, and with Friends it was like so it was definitely like it made steps in the right direction in some areas and then back in the other, you know, and but still had improvements to make sure.
That's always the thing. That is always the case when you go. You know, there's always progress in it, hand in hand with, you know, it's, things are of their time, no matter how progressive they are. It's very rare that you get somebody who can completely, you know, escape from their, you know, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, how many civil rights activists through the 60s were shit to women, right? Like, you know, it's,
you get feminists who were anti-Semitic, and you know, there's always the problems, but you know, you gotta, history is dirty, you gotta take it.
Exactly. Yeah. And
it's great to celebrate it, acknowledge that it was very bad, but you know, try to do better. And I don't know what I'm saying, it's complex, I guess, is what we're saying, right?
And yeah, and I think like nostalgia can definitely, like, it's a cloud.
The point there is not to go like Friends, it's not to oversimplify, right? Have that critical thing. Friends was great in terms of its portrayal of women, but it was awful for homophobia. Like you can say both things and still enjoy Friends.
Yes, for sure. Oh, I mean I am probably, like, there's going to be all kinds of problematic stuff that I have a fondness for, you know, and I think that's the case for everyone, really, isn't it?
I definitely have a line, like, I kind of avoid anything Lovecraft based, just because, like, even for his time he was so racist.
Yeah.
And like, the work isn't the person, I get that, like, you know, we can enjoy the work and blah blah blah, but I mean, the work is incredibly racist, but you know, things derive from, you know, if there's a game about Cthulhu or whatever, I'm not saying I will not play any game based on Cthulhu, but I do shy away from it just because of how astonishingly racist he was.
I don't know if I've got like a line I know where it is, but there's for sure there's a line. It's a case of seeing things for what they are, but also, like, I think that there is, like you were saying with how Mac were cutting the 32-bit support and stuff, is like, sometimes it's okay to have a clean break, right? It's okay to move forward with progress, not to let
get a bit of a bit more of a sophisticated, like I said, with the, you know, part of the reason why the 50s was so great for the people it was great for was, you know, the spending under FDR, like, get yourself a bit of a more complex understanding, you know, and it's not that simple, I'm simplifying, of course, but you know, think about things in a more complex way and enjoy them in a more complex way. Because, I mean, that's, you know, when you see, I don't want to get into specifics and politics, but, you know, the Trumpian style of politics, or the, you know, the Boris Johnsonian style of politics, just that tendency to massively simplify, to say, you know, X is bad, Y is great. That's never the case. You know?
Exactly, yeah.
Like, yeah, a bit of nuance.
And it's, yeah, but it is also, it is playing into that.
Yeah,
for sure. So I've been thinking a lot about, you know, like a lot about that kind of stuff. Actually, interestingly enough, I have been sorting through my photos recently, right? So I've been becoming very familiar with my memories and my perception of the past, because I've pulled off my photos from Google Photos, and I'm using them as files again. So I'm not using the big long timeline that you get with Google Photos.
Yeah.
I'm actually storing them the old-fashioned way, in folders, and I sorted through
Hang
all
on,
of them because.
for younger listeners, could you describe what a folder is?
Probably not really.
It's very, very hard. Yeah, I was joking, obviously, but you
For
just don't
sure,
get them on
yeah.
phone, right? You're like,
Well, I mean, I've got a file manager on my phone, a simple file
Oh no, they
manager, so.
exist, but like, unless you install a file manager, you're never going to be exposed to a folder on a phone, really, right?
Yeah, I suppose so. Even Google Files, the Google File Manager in
Yeah, no, it pretends it's all flat,
it
right?
yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
But I painstaking, well, not necessarily painstakingly, but I went through all my old photographs and I deleted the ones that I didn't want or didn't feel were of any value to them. I cut about half of my photos all in all. There were some photos that were like a set, right? So they were like maybe I did a photo shoot for I did a photo shoot for a junk shop, and I've got a set of really nice photographs of just old junk that was in this junk shop. Great set of photos. That was fine, like, but there were a lot of stuff that I took just almost like, oh, I'm out and about, I'm going to take some nice things. I actually ended up getting rid of a lot of still life, a lot of like, oh, that's a pretty flower, I'm going to take a picture of that pretty flower. I kind of like hate still life now, because it's like, oh, it's a picture of a nice lake, it's a picture of a nice view. I mean, it might as well be a postcard. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm literally like, and in terms of like, as a photo, not to be too snobby or anything, but in terms of as a photography skill, it's like the base level of doing something, right? It's just like you go to a nice place, you take a photograph, you obey some basic rules about lighting and the rule of thirds and all that kind of stuff. But anyone can pick that up from a YouTube video, all that kind of stuff, and. This is a little bit of me working in the newspaper and stuff like that, but like to me, the real skill of a photograph is capturing something that ideally only happens once, right? Like it's you're capturing a moment, right? So my favorite photograph, or I've got a few favorite photographs. One of my favorite photographs that I've taken was the day before lockdown, where I was locking up the office at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I went out onto the street and it was just empty. And I've never seen the street that empty. One person, one car in the whole of a high street. And I took a photograph of it because I thought there is a very distinct possibility. Never in my lifetime will I see that's the street that empty in the middle of the day. Like that's a phenomenon. It was like something. It was like being in a film. It's like 28 days later or something like that. Like it was crazy. And actually, interestingly enough, another one of my favorite photographs is from the 2019 election hustings, where there was
I
this,
know the one you're talking about. It's a really nice photograph of that. It's got that, it's almost got that accidental renaissance or whatever the,
yes, yeah, accidental renaissance, where,
renaissance is Baroque, but yeah, we don't need to
yeah,
quibble.
and it was in this village hall, packed in, standing room only, and it was like, and there was there's a little sign at the far end which read, "This is our happy place," right? Just like you would get in a village hall. It even had the little canteen shutter down, like how they do the little. It was just a perfect scene. There were people lying down left and right, and there was the person standing at the back who was the chair of the hustings with a microphone. It was like it was organic enough that it felt real. Well, it felt real because it was real, but also it was just framed perfectly and beautifully, and it gave this it was one of those photographs that portrayed the feeling of the room as I remember it being, as it was, which
And
is
that comes across as somebody who's only seen the photographs. That comes across. That really does. You
yes, like
know what the energy was in that room.
yeah, the hustle, the bustle, the this is an exciting election moment, all that kind of stuff. And to me, that like you that's and it didn't need to have been taken on a camera that good. Like it could have been done on a phone or anything like that, probably like a decent phone ideally, like a but and I think maybe the lens kind of helped, it gave you the right field of view and all that kind of stuff. But and it was luck as well, right? I'm not going to pretend that I planned that. It was just I happened to be in the right place at the right time in the right circumstance. It was a little bit of planning, like showing up is most of the work, right? And just being in the right place. I haven't even like color corrected it or anything like that. Like I could color correct it, but I don't know. It's got that orange glow of the orange light of the room at the time. Like it kind of is as it is.
I think
And I.
you are very much describing like documentary slash reportage photography, right? There is also, just art photography. They overlap massively. They're mostly overlapped, but there is something like it doesn't have to be, just a tree or whatever. If you capture it in a particular way where the shapes just look really beautiful, really interesting, and the intersection of this and that, like, just shapes really, right? Or, an emotional resonance or something like that. There's that kind of photography as well, which I think is it has value.
Like, and I'm certainly not. Well, I was gonna say I'm not like saying what does and doesn't have value, but there are some things like I think don't necessarily like
A mediocre picture of a lake in the Lake District is of no particular. Like you for your memory, fair enough. I'm very anti-photography for myself. I like human memory. I like how vague and dishonest it is sometimes. Like I think that's very human, and I like remembering things without the interference of photography. It's easy for me to say because I'm not going anywhere. But I think I've always kind of felt that, and I that like semi-mythical thing. That tribes that believe that photography steals your soul. I kind of wish we were a little bit more like that, a little bit more anti-photography.
So I've popped a photo, my most recent photo that I quite like, into the chat,
I see it. Yep.
which is
Oh, I saw that on Mastodon. Yeah, I love that.
So what happened there is I was covering for the newspaper the proclamation of King Charles III. So this for our non-UK friends, this is basically when the town crier in a silly outfit goes to a prominent place in every British small village, reads from a scroll, "Hear ye, hear ye, we proclaim Charles III as king of the
I
United
thought for a
Kingdom."
moment you were going to inform our international listeners that the Queen had died, like as if they hadn't heard about it. You might not have heard.
and so I took this photograph, and the cam I took loads of photographs as part for a spread on the paper, but this one photograph accidentally autofocused on the backs of the heads of the front row of the crowd. And almost everyone in, not well, I say almost everyone, like a large segment of the crowd were filming this on their phones. And
I think what's lovely is it's not that it's focused on their heads. It's focused on somebody take a photo of what you were trying to take a photo of. I think that's what's lovely about it, or somebody recording it, whatever.
And it's like there were so many people there that were doing that, recording it, photographing it. It was a whole line of people with phones being held up. And I don't necessarily want to comment on whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing, because whether or not, if we lived in a world without smartphones, maybe those people would still have been there and just watching it, and maybe they wouldn't have. It's not, I couldn't say. But it's interesting that we're there in person and still watching it through a screen. Like maybe that might say something artful. Maybe, there's something to be said, like you say, about you liking the mystery of the human memory, and that might be a time when that's lost for a lot of people. I just felt like it captured the moment there so well that the prominent thing in the room, well, in the place, was that everyone held a phone up. And I thought that was just like remarkable. And I felt weirdly old-fashioned there with an old DSLR camera.
There's also a nice artistic irony that like you obviously you're intending to take a picture of this thing, and you still have, but on a screen, like you still have a picture of the thing you wanted to take. I mean, that's kind of nice.
And so I think that's just like I yeah and I it's just an interesting perspective on where I was at that. And I love it, really. It just came out again. That one is not at all edited. Some, you know, like I sometimes I'll tweak a little color here and there, but like for the most part, it's not the exact, it's like showing up is 90% of the work as far as I'm concerned, right? Like it's the, yeah, sure, the artistic stuff is great, but if we're doing an artistic-y photograph, maybe drawing is better. Maybe there's a better medium for it.
Yeah.
Than photography.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I'm not like, you know, I'm not anti photography. I don't hate photography, but like I do think, like you say, it's whether it's a problem or not that this many people record. I don't think it's a problem or not a problem. I think, but what it is, it's a waste of everybody's time. We don't need a million recordings of everything. Yeah. You're never going to, like, the majority, like the 99.9999%, they're never going to look at these things ever again. Like,
exactly.
And it might just be a generational thing. We have the ability to do this, and we're the first generation who's had the ability to do this, and we don't have the maturity with it yet. I think we'll come to realize that we don't need to photograph and video absolutely everything. we're gonna get that at some point.
Yeah, it was kind of surprising the number of people that were doing it, but yeah, like, and we're always growing as a society. We're always changing, and
it's new technology. We're bound to, you know, be a bit over enthusiastic.
For sure, for sure. But also, like, with the Google services, even though with Google Photos there is a file size limit, we do seem to live in this technological world where things are expected to be archived and not really ever deleted. That you can scroll back 10 years on your phone and see all that kind of stuff. Which when I went through my photos, I got rid of, like, so many still life pictures of flowers that I had long since forgotten and stopped caring about. Memories, actually, interestingly enough, that I did keep. I kept almost every selfie with another person. I think they were like, I kind of, in a way, think that those kind of selfies, there is a profoundness to them. That there is a, that's a moment in time that I think it aids the thing.
The thing I was saying about memory is that that's not a moral judgment. That's just a preference. I'd rather not have the selfies and rather have the vague memory. If you'd rather have the, you know, the interaction of memory and selfie, then that's totally cool. It's not, you know, it's not.
But the selfie itself, like it, I find that it aids that memory, right? Like it aids that fuzziness, right? Like it just takes you back there for a moment, and then the rest of it is on you. Funnily enough, actually, I think, like, you and my dad are probably of the same mindset. When my sister got married, I videoed the thing and I edited the video, and I was really happy with how it came out. And my dad can't watch it. He has this like memory of it, of being there, that he has no interest whatsoever in ever, doesn't want, like, photos. Yeah. Yes. Because it kind of, like, your brain is doing a lot of the work there with the photos. But when it comes to video,
that's interesting. That's cool.
Yeah, it's too real. It's too, like,
it's too stark. I think it's too. It's not how you remember it. You know, like, say, memory is hazy and fuzzy and warm, and you know, like, and the stark, perfect, crisp video is not like that.
No,
it almost intrudes.
Yes, it reminds me of an expression. I can't remember where I heard it. I'm sure it was by a famous writer or something. Which is, you'll forget what people say, but you'll never forget how they made you feel. No, was it? Yeah, something like, people will forget what you say, but they'll never forget how you made them feel.
I'm like that, because my short-term memory is so appalling. Like, when I'm trying, there's a game that I love, and I'm trying to describe it to somebody, and I've forgotten it. I remember how it made me feel. You know, so I'm like, I'm halfway between trying to describe the game, realizing I can't remember, like, how that works, how this works, but I remember how it made me feel, and I hope that I can communicate that.
And that's, so I think with photographs, and particularly with selfies of just yourself, it's a bit weird to keep a collection of those, right? but with people, with friends, with family, all that kind of stuff, I look back on them and I enjoyed them. It was interesting to see what I kept and what stayed behind.
I think it's an interesting process. Because at the time you have no idea, right? But then looking back years later, certain things have value and certain things don't, right?
Yeah, and events as well. They like not necessarily events that that were personally important to me. There's a stack here that I took for the paper that I think are like they came out nice. Like they are a nice record. A record isn't necessarily the right thing because like even when we do news reports, we're not really taking a beat by beat record. We're, you know, again, we're trying to describe the vibe, the feeling, the way I think of it is like, what would you say if you were describing it to someone over a pint or something like that, right? Like it's
You're painting a picture.
painting a picture. Yeah, exactly. So, but yeah, no, I cut down a lot, and I actually very much prefer the folder hierarchy. It's not much of a hierarchy. Like it's, I've got a folder called pictures, and then all of it's in albums, or folders. But I noticed how much junk there was in the Google Photos timeline, and that obscured so much of the quality stuff. Like the quality stuff was on the same hierarchical level as the junk. I had a lot of things, for example, I took a photo of a receipt to claim back on expenses or something like that. That was on the same level of hierarchy as you know, a holiday with friends from like 5 years ago that's a very fond memory, you know, like it's I you know, I do like the idea of categorizing and sorting things, but we don't, I know we don't like necessarily live in that world anymore. I know that people are I don't know, I
Well,
suppose maybe.
it's done when I've seen a friend interacting with app whatever Apple Photos thing is called. Like she'll pull up like just a picture of herself in a particular situation, and it'll be like, and then Apple Photos is like, here are all the other pictures of you in that kind of situation. You know, it's algorithmically deciding what is similar, which is kind of cool and impressive, but it's a very different way of looking at things, and there's a tension there, and it would be nice to be able to pick and choose which, you know, I don't know what I'm saying really, other than this is one of the things we're going to have to deal with in the going into the future, right? You know what I mean?
Well, Google Photos is a bit like that. Like you can literally search for things that have no metadata. You can search trees or you
Exactly.
know, Christmas or
And
something like that.
we're going to have to decide what parts of our life we want organizing by AI and oh, I said there was an interesting post on Mastodon the other day about the kind of attacks you can do on AI, and the example was like an ordering attack. So this is an AI that's trained. It's an AI, the purpose of which is to decide whether somebody should have a loan or not. And the point of using AI for stuff like this is that we don't know what it's doing, but it's looking at things that humans would never think of, and because they correlate, it's making the best decisions in theory, right? But AI needs to be trained, and this attack involves the first 10 candidates you show it are women who shouldn't be given loans. And then the AI decides that women shouldn't be given loans, right? So we've got to be very careful with these things.
That is kind of interesting. It's like the correlation of the rise in radio is like inversely parallel to the amount of violent crime. Like, does that mean that more people owning radios means that less people are violent? You know, and things like that. Yeah, it's I can imagine, a lot of interesting AI attacks happen that way.
AI is going to be hugely involved in you know, like, I mean, obviously people are training it to decide whether people deserve loans or not, for starters, which is scary. But you know, I'm not anti-technologist. You know, I'm sure so long as it's well trained and so long as it's supervised, it's going to be better at a lot of things, and that's fine. That's cool. We should absolutely use technology when it benefits us, but we should think about. We should well. I'll just say the one thing: we should think about who's in control of it. That's important. Who is it serving for what purpose?
And also, like, are we gonna become dependent on an opaque algorithm?
I'm not as worried about that as some people are. We've
But we're quite
there's an
dependent
ex
on, you know, a lot of things that are algorithmic at the moment, right? Like, I mean, even just a
yeah.
search engine.
And we're also, you know, many of the technologies that I use are opaque to me. I mean, I guess the point there is they're not. There's somebody to whom they're not opaque.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. We've got to be careful with technology, but we've also got to be careful of being scared of technology. We are a cybernetic race. You know, since the first human picked up a stick and used it as a tool, we are cybernetic, right? We are tool using, technology based species, and we can't be afraid of that. That's our nature.
No, and we also can't push back the tide as well. Like, we can't. Yeah. Like, there is going to be technology that's the smartphone, for example. Like, and I'd be interested actually if there's anyone watching this. First of all, this far in, well done. But also, like, I feel that at this stage now, smartphones are not an optional technology, or at the very, or we're approaching such a time. I think the COVID passports were very close to it, where there was stuff that in reality you could only do online or on the COVID app. Also going to be things with, when it comes to banking, for example. If you're not near a post office, the only way to pay in a check is to take a photograph of it on your banking app. To verify your identity.
Didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Although I think that's more an argument against checks than for.
I mean, checks are on the way out, but there are some things like certain bank accounts for, like, if you like village hall bank accounts and things like that, where they just don't get updated in forever, and you know, it's rare that I come across checks these days, but on occasion I see them. But it's usually it's usually expenses for a village fete or something. And also, like, verifying your, I'm sure there's something I had to verify my identity for that I need a phone for, where you take a photo of your face and then they use the algorithms to match up your eyes and all that kind of stuff.
That's
definitely becoming more common. So, you know, I don't like it, but also I can't change it.
Well, I mean, what I don't like is it's controlled by corporations who are serving capital. That's my problem with it. But I don't think that should translate to hating the technology.
For sure.
You can question things about it, question its use, question who's in control without... I mean, some technology will be questionable. I'm not saying technology is inherently great. But, you know, like, yeah, separate the structural from the technological and then hopefully, you know, get this stuff in public hands more. That would be great.
That'd be nice. And I think that when, like, in ideal circumstances, where technology can be replicated in an open source free software matter, I think that's where you get the best of it. And it's nuanced as well, right? Like, there's going to be, it'd be nice to blanket things. It feels good to make general generalizations and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, we're two white men in a white man's world, right? Like, there are going to be things like, I'm not, you know, scared of the, you know, necessarily having my data used against me, but that's not to say, who knows what the future holds, but also that's not necessarily to say that's applicable for you know, like a gay person in Egypt, for example.
Yep.
You know, it's right. Should we wrap up the podcast? Because
I've got a quick one before we do. This is just something. Sure. There's I know you've interacted with this person as well. To me, a new YouTuber. Mm-hmm. I've got the name here. I've forgotten it off the top of my head. Where are we? Veronica Explains.
Oh, yes.
I don't know if they're new on you. I think they're fairly new on YouTube, but they started popping up on my YouTube, and then I noticed them on Mastodon, and she's kind of come out of nowhere. But, like, great videos.
Yes, fully agree.
So just Yep, it's Veronica Explains on YouTube. They're also on Mastodon. They're also videos are also on PeerTube. I'm not going to give you all the blah blahs, but yeah, really good. More, not, less like your stuff, like more scripted, more definitely more prepared. But yeah, really cool. Her latest video is she's using a Model M and doing some really clever stuff with it, and it's pretty cool. So yeah, just a recommendation.
Awesome. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I second that recommendation. Yeah, and yeah, actually, yeah. I mean, is Veronica Explains new?
New to me.
Yeah, but... certainly new to me. New to the Fediverse as well. But
yeah,
but the quality of videos is so good.
Yeah, let's have a look. I'm looking at the videos now. When was there? A year ago. Yeah, so they're like fairly new, but been going a while. So yeah. But yeah, so the videos are they've got that charm, you know, that works without being too like sleazy YouTube. You know, I don't want that, but I do want like a bit of charm and a bit of wit and a bit of, you know, like actually caring about the videos. The opposite of, you know, anything I've ever made. really good, really insightful, well prepared, well, really well researched to the point where. I mean, she's a woman making YouTube videos about technology, right? So she gets problems with men either thinking like a man has written the script for her or, you know, any of that nonsense. To the point where she caveats every single thing she says in the video. Like, I know that this isn't the case. Don't comment about this. And like, yeah, which is awful for her, I'm sure. But the videos are great. That's,
Absolutely. I'm probably not going to add like various links into the podcast notes onto this kind of thing in as a general rule, going back to the, we don't want to end up making this whole podcast work and effort and stuff like that.
Seriously, so, go to YouTube and search for Veronica Explains.
It's normal. Need. Yeah. But that also is going to go for
200 years time and YouTube doesn't exist anymore. I guess tough luck.
I don't know. I feel like I should just preface that in like, was it start as you mean to go on? Like, did we say this before? I don't know if this was recorded at the beginning or whether or not we said it before, but I think we have said it on this podcast again. So I think I'm doing that thing where I go over stuff. It's worse when I do a few takes.
Charm, Chris.
Yeah. I mean, someone did say I go over myself a few times, but when I'm doing like a one hit, like casual kind of thing, I kind of want to make sure everything's covered.
What was it? What was the thing?
The thing was, podcasts, even though they often seem like two people just in a room having a chat, they often end up being a lot more work than they look like. However, neither me or Drew are signing on for work. So this is going to literally be authentic, and as a result of that, expect maybe some rough edges and such. But you know, it's genuine authenticity, and that might not always necessarily be as, I don't know, smooth as it's supposed to be. I mean, I might leave in that bit where I did the advert for the Fediverse, sponsored by some vague amorphous 10-year-old.
Absolutely keep that in. It's great.
Well, cool. All right. So
about NordVPN.
NordVPN. Oh, Raid Shadow Legends.
Raid Shadow Legends. What are the others? You that shaving know. One. What's the shaving one?
Oh, Dollar Shave Club.
Wix. Yeah. Wix. You can make a website.
I always feel like a channel has hit rock bottom when they do Raid Shadow Legends. It feels like they're the ones that will sponsor anyone. So You've been cancelled for being a racist. Well, I'm sure Raid Shadow Legends will still give you some money. I on occasion consider actually playing Raid Shadow Legends to see if it's as bad as it looks, but I don't want that on my phone. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
It looks terrible, but it also looks dodgy. Like,
yeah, no, it does. It looks like it's farming, mining bitcoins in the background, or stealing your credit card, or something. It's doing something. That's probably we've probably libeled it, slandered it, or whatever you do to products.
I assume we're a pretty anti NFT crypto kind of podcast, right? Is that Yeah. I don't think we. I don't know. Like, yeah, I don't like them.
They're, if you're listening to this and you're pro NFT or maybe even pro crypto, like, I don't want you listening. Go away.
After listening for 2 hours. 2 hours. I quite like. I put some of my photographs on Mastodon.art on a separate account, and they've taken a stance against NFTs. It's like NFTs is part of, like,
yeah, that's good. Yeah, I think anybody sensible is, right? Anyway, yeah. End it, Chris. We're going to walk on forever.
Yeah, end it. Okay. Thank you for joining us. Thank you, Drew, for joining me. Thank you, me, for joining me. And if you've got any feedback, questions, all that kind of stuff, best place to get us is on the Fediverse, because that's where we'd be. And Ahara Mateys? Is that? Yeah.
Ahoy, ahoy.